From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Happy Thanksgiving. Coming up on Forum, a pre-recorded hour on this Thanksgiving Day with famed novelist Philip Roth. We'll talk with him about his newest novel, Nemesis, which takes us back to New Jersey in 1944 and the polio epidemic. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Philip Roth has also won, in addition to a Pulitzer, a National Book Award twice and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and received the National Medal of Arts at the White House in 2002. He's a three-time recipient of the Penn Faulkner Award, and in 2005, The Plot Against America, which we interviewed him on, received the Society of American Historians Prize. He is the only American novelist to have his work published in a comprehensive, definitive edition by the Library of Congress, the last of nine volumes scheduled for publication in 2013. Philip Roth's newest novel is Nemesis. It's set in 1944 in Newark and at a summer camp in the Poconos during the war and during the time that a raging polio epidemic was taking place. And it concerns the fortunes of an honorable and decent young man, a playground coordinator by the name of Bucky Cantor. Philip Roth joins us for this Forum Hour, and so pleased to have you back here on Forum with us, Philip Roth.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Well, I'm going to begin with just an editorial comment, and I rarely do this because I'm the interlocutor, not the critic, but I am also someone who wears that critical hat sometimes. And I must tell you, this book had a punch, and you've used that metaphor about the last quartet of books that you've done, these kind of shorter you were inspired, I know, by Sal Bellow to do shorter novels. It delivers, is what I wanted to say, and it delivers in a very visceral way. And I guess I must ask you, first of all, if that was your intention upon me and other readers who at the end I wound up saying, damn you, Roth, you did it again.
Yes, well, one wants to deliver, or as I've been saying, pack a punch. It's a very grim subject. Then, of course, it led to the maiming and crippling of tens of thousands of children. So anything that makes children suffer and blights their lives is devastating.
Yeah, I want to get into that with you because you do take up theodicy and you take up these big questions about children suffering. But what I found so palpable was the sense of terror. You recreated that sense of terror, the fear and ignorance that went with it of what caused polio. And your memories are so acute here that I want to go into it with you somewhat because, I mean, I imagine that it was pretty graphic in your memory, not only trying to find the source and blaming all kinds of sources, but also the iron lungs, the fear of paralysis, the deaths.
It was unforgettable. Polio was the menace of my or our childhood. Excuse me, yours as much as mine. I was born in 1933. You were born in the 1940s. There were people who were born in the 1920s. And the heyday of polio was in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and early 1950s until finally the vaccine knocked it out. So it was hard to forget. The other menace to our lives in that period was World War II. That was a bit more distant. It wasn't unpresent just because it was being fought abroad. Brothers, fathers, etc. from the neighborhood had gone into the army, navy, etc. They'd been wounded. They'd been killed. So we were very conscious of the war, but more immediately we were conscious of the polio in the best season of the year for us, which was the summer. The worst menace was there.
It took over the war news, as you point out in your book. And the summer was very hot, the summer you write about in 1944, so hot that, well, it seemed as if somehow the heat of the summer was tied to polio.
Yeah, someone proposes in this book that the sun is the cause. There was no known cause, which made it even more terrifying. And there was no known cure, which made it more terrifying. So here was this disease that came like the plague. Once again, I repeat, it attacked some adults, most notably FDR, but it attacked children.
And here we have a young man who works with children, Bucky Cantor, Mr. Cantor, as he's called, and we don't find out actually who the narrator is. I'm going to maybe ask you about that until about 100 pages into the book. But it almost sounds like a chorus in some ways, and I thought that was very inventive, and it certainly engaged me, that voice that knew Mr. Cantor and admired him. And we have another really good boy. I mean, you know, we've talked before about how you write about good boys and bad boys, and this is an honorable boy. This is someone who's sturdy and reliable. I wondered why you made his father a thief, though.
Well, I suppose I wanted to afflict him with real burdens so that his effort to become an honorable young man was terrific. He wanted not only to become a good fellow, as many others did, but he wanted to escape the shadow of his father, who was a convicted felon, who was a bookkeeper who robbed from his employers. And in addition to that, as you know, his mother dies in childbirth. And so he's taken to live with his grandparents, who are terrific people. But nonetheless, he always feels the absence of the mother he never knew and the father he doesn't want to know.
And he also has eyesight problems, which keep him from going off to the war. And as I said, he's honorable, wants to go off with his buddies and fight the Nazis and be a part of the World War II effort. The shame he felt as a result of not being able to go to the war, was that again, you know, something that you encountered in some boys who couldn't go?
Well, I was too young to know about that. I was 8 when the war began, and I was 12, I think, when it ended. So I wouldn't have known that was so, but I now surmise that was so.
You also present Bucky as having heroic characteristics and being, I think the phrase you use is having natural goodness. He has a sense of duty. He has a kind of nobility about him. And I'm wondering if there's something that makes you feel that there is a phenomenon as natural goodness. Is it part of maybe the way we're wired and nurtured and we become naturally good?
Some of us.
Some of us, yeah. That was implied in the question, yeah.
Some of us. Yeah, I think there are some who are wired, as you say, that way. Bucky is one. I think there are kids or young men of 22, like Bucky or 23, who are temperamentally that way from the start of life. He's helped along by his grandfather, who is rigorously responsible. And so is Bucky rigorously responsible, which is to say he has a highly developed conscience. And it's his responsibility and his conscience that cause him pain.
And that also make him believe in sportsmanship and in helping young boys to understand the importance of sportsmanship and high ideals that have to do with the body and perhaps a more aspiring and loftier ethical concept of life.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I'd say that was certainly true of the playground directors, some of them that we had as kids. I must have known, say, 3 different ones during my life as a boy on the playground, and who think that there's a kind of virtue intrinsic to sports. Mostly, what he likes to do is play the sport, and his sport is throwing the javelin. And at the end of the book, you see him take delight really in exquisitely throwing the javelin.
And you call up all kinds of Attic and Hellenistic imagery in that last passage with the javelin because it was something so common in ancient Greece.
Well, I do, yeah.
I'm also struck in, well, I'm struck by so many things in this book, but talking about natural goodness, there's almost a kind of propensity toward malice when the book begins and some Italian kids from another part of town come and essentially do something pretty vile. I don't want to necessarily give away too many of the plot elements here, but this gets the novel kicked in. And they do it out of, I suppose, maybe what Coleridge would call motiveless malignity or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. That and considerable anti-Semitism. They come up to the Jewish quarter of the town, the Jewish district, which is where the book takes place and where Bucky and the kids are. And they say, when Bucky says to them, what do you guys want? 10 of them come up in two cars. And he says, we're spreading polio. And he stands between these 10 guys and his boys. And afterwards, there are people in the community who believe, when asked who brought the polio to the weak link section? They said the Italians. So they're constantly, like as people do, trying to find the cause of this thing, and the cause often resides in what's strange and alien,
including in this case a mentally disabled boy in one episode in the novel.
Yeah, there's a character in the book called Horace. Who all the kids call the moron. Now, actually, it's not as defamatory as it sounds, because the scientific categories of low IQs were divided into three groups scientifically back in that period: imbeciles, idiots, and morons. I think the morons had the intelligence of 12-year-olds, the idiots from, I may have this wrong, but from, let's say, 5 to 11, and the other group 5 and below. And strictly speaking, in those terms, Horace would have been less than a moron. So moron is the word they use to talk about him. And he's before there's polio, or in the seasons there isn't polio, the greatest menace in the neighborhood is Horace, which is a measure of how small the menace was. But he's quite ugly and ill-formed and certainly something that a kid 5, 6, 7, even 8 years old would run away from or hide from. But he hangs around the kids at the playground. And I remember that from my own time at the playground. There was a guy in our neighborhood who was, I think he was in his early 20s, late 20s, named Leroy. He was a very pathetic creature. But he walked all the time, walked around the neighborhood. He had nothing else to do. He lived at home, as such people did in those in that era, and then even after he was an adult man, he lived at home like a child, and wandered the neighborhood, and would come up whenever we were playing ball and sit on the sidelines and watch. By watch, I mean he just sat there and absorbed the fact that there were other creatures with him.
Did he just want to shake hands like Horace?
He liked to shake hands, yeah. And there were things he was afraid of, which was very interesting. The kids who taunted him, and there were such kids, found that he didn't like it if you tapped your foot on the board of the bleachers where we sat between innings, and they would tap their feet on the and drive him quite crazy. Really, well, I put that in the book. I never forgot it, and I put it in the book.
No,
I don't know whatever became of it.
It's striking, though, how the kids can be cruel to him, even some of the good or well-meaning kids. But it also struck me that it showed to what extent the search among children, and of course even Bucky gets things thrown at him in terms of the polio epidemic, how at a time of terror, like you described, there's hunger for scapegoating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And also there's the search for the cause. And one of the kids, the brightest of the kids actually, says that Horace is the carrier. Horace is spreading polio. So that the search for a cause goes on throughout the book.
Throughout the book, there's also a love affair and actually very tender love affair between Bucky, the main character, and a young woman named Marcia. I must tell you, you know, as someone familiar with your work through the years, I was struck again by how, and I believe I remember you reading you saying something to this effect. You may have even said it to me, that sometimes when you have a strong father, Dr. Steinberg, Marcia's father, is a strong and good man, you often have a really good daughter, good woman. I mean, it seems to be almost a kind of Philip Roth equation in some ways.
Well, I would imagine having a loving, strong, reasonable father never hurt anybody, boy or girl, man or woman. But she has such a person, Dr. Steinberg. He's an important character, not just to his daughter, and he is to her, but to Bucky, too, because Bucky is drawn to Marcia as much by her family as he is by her. Not as a social climber or not looking for money, but they represent an idea of civilized life that he, who's come from sort of nowhere, would like to attach himself to. And so one of the most important scenes in the book occurs in a conversation between Bucky and Dr. Steinberg, when Bucky says, I want to become engaged to your daughter.
That's also a conversation where you put a great deal of focus on a peach. And it's something, something I was quite struck by, how that peach stays, the sweetness of that peach stays with him.
Well, if there's anything better than a strong, loving father, it's a good peach.
I'm thinking a proof rock who said, dare I eat a peach? But
yes. Yeah, well, it's a kind of ritual that takes place between Dr. Steinberg and Bucky when Bucky's visiting him because he's confused about the epidemic and wants to speak to Dr. Steinberg as a doctor, really, and say, what the hell is going on here? Where does this come from? When's it going to stop? And so on. And they have this conversation, and he's so comforted by Dr. Steinberg's reasonable, seemingly scientific answers that when he asks Bucky if he'd like a peach, he says, sure, there's one right there in the bowl on the back screen in the back porch. And they both eat this wonderful peach together, and it becomes a terrifically strong moment in Bucky's young life. And it prompts him to ask for Marcia's hand. I think we all have had half a dozen or a dozen such moments in our young lives until we were 21 or so, where the event and the thing, the props in the room are all part of some joy we felt at some moment.
He also wants exoneration in a way when he goes to see Dr. Steinberg because some woman has accused him again of being the source and the cause of polio.
That's true. I forgot that. Yeah, two of the boys, two of the nastiest little boys on the playground get polio together, and the mother, he calls to find out how they're doing, and the mother says, you're responsible for this by letting them run around and getting soaking wet and so on. And he's thrown by that. He's never been accused of anything like that before in his life, never.
Nasty boys get killed by polio. Good boys get killed by polio. And it brings you, in Bucky's mind, right to the question of God and theodicy and what appears to him to be that there must be some malice behind a plan if there is a God. Only a fiend could kill these children wantonly and kill them so cruelly. And it seemed to me, and I wanted to really get your perspective on this, because it seemed to me that you were working with an idea which is, I suppose, one that many atheists work with, understandably. But through Bucky's thinking, which would have been highly unconventional for the time and also for someone of sort of non-cerebral characteristics like Bucky, I wonder if it was a leap for you to go there in Bucky's head.
No, not really. I think you've got to be pretty feeble not to ask that question if you're in the midst of a disaster, whether it's a war or a Holocaust or an epidemic. And if you're in the midst of an epidemic that's killing and crippling the children you love, and he's like one big parent, he has all the children. Parents only have one or two. He has all these kids, and he is half in love with them. And you have to be feeble, I think, not to say, well, what's behind this? Not the flies and not the Italians, but what's behind this is God. Who made this polio virus? And if so, why? Why did he do this, or she, or whatever we want to call this God? And so he works his way to that critical question quite by himself. You don't have to be any smarter than Bucky is, though he's not stupid, he just has an ordinary intelligence. You don't have to be any smarter than Bucky is, it seems to me, to ask that question in such moments.
He knows.
Where's God in all this?
He certainly goes beyond saying, where's God, though? And his Marcia, for example, and Dr. Steinberg and those people who he admires and so forth never question the way he does, but he gets to the point where he says, maybe a sun god would be better. Maybe it'd be better to be a pagan. His mind stretches, in other words, given the what Terry Eagleton would call the superstructure of the times that he lived in, and I was struck by that.
Well, it isn't something I thought I was going to get to in this book, but I mean, a book always unfolds as you write it. You don't know what you're going to get to. You just hope that if you put the right foot in the right place and the next foot and so on, it's going to carry you to good places. But I did get to this, and I was glad I did. I thought it enriched the story. It enriched him. And he was asking vital and crucial human questions.
He also asks, when a particularly good boy dies, he has the insight, and I was quite struck by it, that when he sees how much the parents are grieving and when he sees how bereaved they are, he says, this boy will be 12 forever. For a million years, he'll be 12.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just found that very poignant because, again, it's an insight that is sort of unavoidable when you see a child's life taken so senselessly at that young an age.
Absolutely.
I mean, does emotion well up when you write these kind of poignant things? Doesn't.
No, it doesn't. I don't feel the emotions that the characters feel. I'm trying to present how and why they feel them.
None of this T.S. Eliot depersonalization or avoiding the secretions of the heart for Philip Roth. Although the tenderness, the emotion, it's all there in the characters where, I guess from your perspective, it ought to be. We'll come back after a brief break. We'll talk more with Philip Roth. His new book is Nemesis. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Michael Krasny. We're talking with famed novelist Philip Roth, whose newest novel is called Nemesis, and it takes place in 1944 at the time the Second World War obviously was going on, but also at the time the height of the polio epidemic in Newark and in the Poconos, and we'll talk about the Poconos in a moment because I want to find out about the summer camp that Philip Roth takes us to in the book, but also wanting to ask you about sort of your need to explore certain historical phenomena like the Korean War, like polio. It's almost as if something's driving you to these, well, parts of your youth, I guess, is a way to describe it.
Well, they're terrifically interesting to me. That's what's driving me. They're unforgettable. They're landmarks in my coming of age and even in my maturity, such as the Vietnam War's place the domestic consequences of the Vietnam War in American pastoral. But going back to these years of the, say, the polio epidemics before the Salk vaccine, these were strong experiences. We didn't have any polio in my neighborhood. I had only one friend who came down with polio, and he recovered. He lived just around the corner from me. But when he did come down with polio, we were all terrified. And our parents were terrified. They were actually terrified all the time, the parents, the mothers and the fathers, or the mothers who were home all day in the neighborhood and saw us around all the time. So could tell us, don't do this and don't do that, because you might get polio. And the kids mostly forgot about it when they went to the playground to play ball or went down to the park to go fishing in the lake or whatever. But whenever they came back within the sphere of the parents, they remembered it. And if someone did get polio, then they surely remembered it. So I never forgot that. I don't see how one could. Since then, I've met a few people who were struck hard with polio. And they're in wheelchairs or they have braces on their legs and they walk with canes or crutches. And it was like being, for a kid, it was like being in a war.
Well, you're chronicling the alternative history almost, because so much affliction takes place in your novel, and yet you're also chronicling the real history, and they're sort of moving together side by side. But I was also mindful of the fact that you're also capturing lost boyhood again.
Not necessarily the most wonderful side of boyhood with this book, but I am going back to that neighborhood, and which I know so well, I don't even have to do any research when I write a book like this. One's childhood, mine, yours, whoever's listening, one's childhood is just embedded. And I find as I get older, and now that I am, now that I qualify for being an old man, that I remember everything, amazingly.
It is amazing, and it's wonderful for those of us who are your readers, but there is some research in here. You open up the book fairly early and it says the 1916 polio epidemic in the northeastern United States, when there had been more than 27,000 cases with 6,000 deaths. In Newark, there had been 1,360 cases and 363 deaths. This is all, I assume, correct statistics that you bring us.
Oh, sure. I needless to say, I read some books about polio. I wanted to find out all I could about it. And those facts are in there because any contemporary reader, current reader, who's under 50, isn't going to know any of that and won't understand the scale of this disease and the amount of suffering it inflicted without my giving him some facts. So there are some facts at the beginning.
I told you before that I was interested in the narration in this book because it's a voice that almost seems like an ancient Greek chorus voice until Arnie Mesnikoff introduces himself to us and says, you know, I'm the narrator and I knew Bucky personally and this is how I found out his story. And I'm curious about how you traveled that particular road in terms of your narrator.
Well, I began telling the story with we. I had that voice right from the beginning. About the neighborhood and about what happened. It happened to us. I had no idea who we was. I knew it was all the kids on the playground, and I wanted this collective voice. Then gradually I realized it was one of the kids who'd been struck with polio. And so at one point, maybe 50 pages in or 40 pages in, I have a list of the kids who'd gotten sick the night before. And he says, and me, Marnie, Arnie Mesnikoff. Then you don't hear from him again. He just goes on with the we. And he calls Bucky Mr. Cantor, as they would have done when they were kids. Back in another era, people were called Mr. Now if you're 90, no child will call you Mr. And I got the idea. I didn't make up this idea. I got the idea from a book that I read from time to time and love. And that's Flaubert's Madame Bovary. In the beginning of Madame Bovary, I think on page one, if you take a look, you'll see that the narrator, who is I, says, I was a friend of Charles Bovary's at boys' school when we were 9 years old. And he tells us all about Charles Bovary as a boy in the school. Charles Bovary is Emma Bovary's hapless doctor husband. And then at about page 10, he disappears. And it's no longer we. I always was charmed by that and couldn't figure it out. I still can't. Whether Flaubert forgot or didn't care or said, take this, you know. And I like to think, in fact, I'm pretty sure Flaubert said, take this. So I thought I would take a crack at it. But I was a little more faithful to that point of view of the narrator.
Talking with Philip Roth, his new book is called Nemesis. And as I had said earlier, we're not only in Newark, but we go into the Poconos, Indian Hill, and a summer camp. And boy, the detail there is wonderful.
I enjoyed that.
I mean, it brings it back. I knew you enjoyed writing it. it's also, let me just, again, without doing too much in the way of plot summary here, but Bucky really doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to leave his charges. And he's kind of enticed by sweet young Marcia when she says there's an island there. And you know, we can be alone. That's very much of the times. I mean, enticing a boy with sexuality, but also, of course, he was deeply emotionally attached to her.
Yeah, well, she's an innocent, however. She's not really a seductress. But mostly why he's enticed by Marsh's offer, which was really the camp director's offer, to come to the camp and take over as a waterfront director from the boy who'd just been drafted and had the job before, is because he's afraid that he's going to get killed by polio. And we'll never have a chance to be Marsha's husband and Dr. Steinberg's son-in-law and Mrs. Steinberg's son-in-law and the whatever you are to her two younger sisters, brother-in-law, and that's what he wants. She may throw in the island as a bit of enticement, but she didn't need to. He wants to get out before he dies. It's his great moment of cowardice. Now, I tend to look at it another way, though I just said the word cowardice. The fact is, had Bucky remained at the playground, what could he do to stop the polio that was ravaging his kids? Nothing. As it turned out, they closed the playground down 2 or 3 days later. He would have been out of a job. But that doesn't mean anything to his own moral appraisal of the situation. He feels guilty, terrifically guilty, cowardly, for running away.
In fact, he has too much. I'm sorry, I was just going to say, he has too much conscience, really, doesn't he? I mean, it's one of the things
I think that's true.
Can't help admiring in him, but yeah.
I think that's true. He has too much conscience, and he has a terrific sense of responsibility, and like many people who have a terrific sense of responsibility, he also has a false sense of responsibility. He thinks he's responsible for what he's not because he thinks he's responsible for everything. And it's this moral side of his nature that intrigued me as I was moving forward in the book, because in the end, when he is in a Sister Kenny hospital for polio victims in Philadelphia, he won't allow Marcia to come to see him. Eventually, he does. She comes, and he says, I'm finished with you. He's crippled. He's badly crippled with polio. And she says, don't be insane. I want to marry you and have a family with you. And he feels that he's redeeming himself morally by renouncing Marcia so she can have a life without him, without this crippled young man. And eventually he sends her away. And eventually he lives a terribly unhappy life because he's alone and crippled. So it's complicated, all that. And there aren't very many pages in this book, but the complexity is there.
The complexity definitely is there. And even before he goes, well, he tenders his resignation to a fellow named O'Gara, who's almost like what Henry James would call a ficelle. I know you studied James as a young man. Yeah? He's a character there to help us move the action forward, and he does in terms of Bucky's conscience because, you know, you're abandoning us is essentially his response, even though Bucky feels he's going to a place that's healthy and clean and he'll be with kids there and it's an opportunity and he'll see Marcia and all of that. And when he gets to the Poconos, I want to get into this with you. There's this moment where butterflies descend upon him. And it's, you know, a striking poetic moment to me as a reader because, well, notwithstanding all the associations of butterflies and the ephemeral, there's something about that moment where almost his flesh is being sucked in by the butterflies and you realize something about his vulnerability and his relationship to nature that's really quite complex again.
Mm-hmm. Well, butterflies, if you remember, descend on the whole camp. There's a swarm, a great, great swarm of butterflies out of nowhere descends on the camp, and there are great numbers of butterflies on the tape of the tennis net, and they're on all the brush and on all the flowers. While Bucky's at the waterfront with the kids, they descend on him, and he has these pools of sweat on his shoulders, and suddenly there's a butterfly sucking his minerals up from Bucky's shoulder. And he's thrilled. He's thrilled. He's thrilled to be alive. He's thrilled to be free from the polio. He thinks he's done it. He's with Marcia. He's with these wonderful kids. He's by this wonderful lake that he likes to dive into. And that's a moment of bliss.
It's also a moment that contrasts in some ways to the polio. I mean, you can have the polio descend ubiquitously and you can have the butterflies descend ubiquitously.
Mm-hmm. God makes butterflies and polio.
Or whatever force makes those things, yes. There's also a moment where Marcia writes, and I remember, I'm old enough to remember when girls and boys did this, they would sometimes just write the name or something about the person they came. She just writes, "My man, my man, my man," over and over again. And the spirit of that and the kind of joyfulness of it and the sort of jejune quality of it is really quite striking.
Well, I think it tells you something about how young she is and how sweet she is. And how in love with him she is, yeah.
Yeah. I'm also mindful in the book about how when polio does strike, there's so much desire to really not only find the source but do something, get the health board more involved or see to it that they're doing what they're presumably charged to do or get quarantine signs all over and everything. Again, you're really dramatizing just the kind of helplessness and the frenetic activity in the wake of something that dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that when I was talking earlier of what we felt as kids when our friend Jerry got polio was, among other things, helpless. Helpless. It could hit any one of us. If it could hit my friend Jerry Schnur, it could hit any one of us.
There is a sense that not only can it hit anyone, but you're dealing, as you are so often in your novels, with a greater sense of menace that's simply out there. I keep thinking, you know, of something like Blake's Tiger or some kind of ferocity that just exists in the universe. Does that resonate for you?
That's interesting. I haven't thought of it that way. I didn't think of Blake. It's a wonderful poem. It's a pretty fierce and powerful poem in itself. I seem always to have been interested, I have been for the last 25 years or so as a writer, in being blindsided. That is, you prepare in life with some diligence to prevent calamity. This even includes going to school and getting good grades and getting a job and working hard at the job and so on. You have a sense of what would be your enemy. I'm going to lose my job. If I lose my job, I'm completely screwed. And then instead you get polio. So the thing you're preparing yourself against, you say, I'm never going to lose this job. I'm going to work so damn hard and so on. And then you get polio and you get blindsided. Swede Lvov in American Pastoral has this wonderful family and has a daughter he adores and a wife he absolutely adores, and she him, and they have a good life. And then their young daughter at age 15 or 16, it's the time of the Vietnam War, becomes an anti-Vietnam War activist, which is fine with him. And then she blows up the post office in the town and kills a doctor who's walking to the post office to mail a letter. So he got blindsided. And this seems to me to be the way it happens, you rarely get it from the thing you're preparing yourself against and take all precautions against, but you get it by the thing you never even thought about.
And that can include from yourself, can't it? It often does in your work. It's not only, you know, something coming out of a blindsided left field that is utterly unanticipated, but it's also sort of working against, maybe in unconscious ways, one could argue, what one thinks is in one's best interest.
Well, what would that be? What book are you thinking of?
Well, I was thinking actually, believe it or not, we're going back a ways here, but I was thinking of something like Portnoy's Complaint. And, you know, there's so much in that book of impulses that get in the way of being a good boy. There even is in Sabbath's Theater to some degree. Not that Mickey Sabbath is a would-be good boy, but I think you understand what I'm asking here, the sense of blindsiding oneself.
Yeah, I think you're right about Portnoy's Complaint. I would, but to talk about Mickey Sabbath in Sabbath's Theater, what Sabbath gets blindsided by and what really determines the shape of his life in every way is that when he's 14 or 15 years old, the brother he just adores, older brother, gets shot down in the plane he's flying over the Philippines in World War II. And he has to experience grief and loss in a way that what 14 or 15 year old can manage. In addition, his mother sort of goes semi-crazy after this happens to his brother, as we can understand why. And his father never speaks after that. He speaks occasionally. His father was never a man who spoke a lot, but he stops talking. So they're all depleted. They're all terribly depleted by what happened to, I forget now the brother's name. And Sabbath, being a big character, big personality with big energies and a terrific imagination, becomes Sabbath. That becoming Mickey Sabbath is his response to that crazy act of loss that fell upon his family.
Life's blindsiding.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. No, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, since we're mentioning other characters from other novels, you're going to go back, do you think, to Zuckerman or Tarnopol or characters who you've spent a good deal of your time as a writer with?
I live way out in the country in Connecticut, and I walk every day in the non-sort of swimming months. And I walk 3-5 miles into town and back. And so everybody knows I take the same course. Not that everybody's watching or anybody cares. And one day I was walking down the road and I get about, I don't know, half a mile down the road. And there's a big sign on one of the trees, nailed into a tree right at the edge of the road, says, "Bring back Portnoy." Now, I live in the middle of nowhere, you know. So I never thought to bring back Portnoy. That was a one-off. I don't think, no, Zuckerman is finished. I think Kepish is finished. I'm afraid I'm on my own.
Well, you're never on your own. You've always got characters that inhabit your life and whose lives you inhabit. When you're speaking about American Pastoral, you know, there are many who say that's your masterpiece, and I'm sure you've been asked this question before, and, you know, the standard boilerplate answer many writers are asked, especially if they're fortunate to be as prolific as you are, is, you know, which child do you favor the most? Or how do you respond to that question?
Well, I like American Pastoral very much. I think it's a fair book. I think it, by which I mean that it presents all the sides fairly. I think the characters are strong. The family is strong. I very much like the wife, Dawn, who had competed for Miss America. Mm-hmm. I got very lucky there. As one does get lucky, blindsided in a positive way, that in the process of writing that, out of the blue, I met an ex-Miss America. And she had been Miss America of 1941 or 42.
That's after Bess Meyerson, isn't it?
I think Bess Meyerson is after the war.
Oh, that's right.
And she had been Miss Louisiana, I think. And I met her. And so we had a long talk. And she told me a lot about the Miss America pageant that I would never have known, you know. And I gave a lot of that stuff to Dawn. And my character, and I began to feel what it was like to be in that America, Miss America contest, and so sometimes you get lucky. I also like very much the book we just mentioned, Sabbath Theater, and I think it's as good as anything I've ever written.
I think it's a terrific book, by the way. I actually liked The Humbling, the last one, a lot, but you seemed a little bit out of the spotlight with that one more than you are, it seems, with, well, the others in the quartet.
I don't know. I don't know much about what the response was to it. I have to tell you that at this stage of the game, I don't worry too much about.
I wasn't thinking about that so much as I was thinking about, you know, you've at least been open to those of us who love your work and who really immensely enjoy interviewing you. Of your last, I think, 5 novels, somehow we didn't connect on The Humbling, and mm-hmm. I thought.
Oh, you mean you and I didn't connect?
You and I, and I didn't see much in the way of your doing interviews on that, which was not true, for example, for the first two and for this one.
Well, maybe I don't remember. And I like The Plot Against America very much.
Me too.
yeah, I'm good. It's there. A world is there. The world is there. It's accurate. The people are strong in themselves, as it turns out, and it's also strong in their presentation. So I like some of the other books too, but let it stand with those three.
Well, when I interviewed you on Indignation, you said, "I've already finished a draft of a book about an actor that was The Humbling." And I was, once again, kind of, as we used to say in the 60s, blown away by the output and productivity of your work. Got something in the works again?
I've been playing with something for a while, but I don't know what will come of it, really. I may be writing this for myself.
Have you done much of that?
I've done some things that haven't worked out, especially in the beginning of my career. I had my share of false starts. You know, when you're trying to figure out what kind of writer you are, and I didn't know, how the hell was I to know when I began? I wrote Goodbye Columbus, and I wrote Letting Go, and I wrote When She Was Good, and I didn't know what kind of writer I was, what kind of books I wrote. And so at that time, I wrote between 62 and 67, when I didn't publish anything, I wrote some false starts. They're dreadful, but if you like dreadful stuff, you can go down to the Library of Congress and read it. It's down there.
Well, I at the risk of sounding like I'm stroking Philip Roth, I think Dreadful Stuff by Philip Roth is pretty damn good.
No, you're in for a surprise.
I'd bet the ranch on that one. Better than certainly a lot of the stuff that, if not most of the stuff that I encounter. It's always, you know, a great pleasure reading you, and it's always an expansion of consciousness as well as, I mean, mind as well as heart. And, you know, we're very fortunate to have you with us, and I hope we have you for a long time more. The book, the new book by Philip Roth is Nemesis. It is out, and it's quite a read. And you don't necessarily have to have remembered or want to remember the polio period and the period of World War II by any means to enjoy this book immensely. In fact, I would really strongly urge younger people to avail themselves of it just to get a sense of that period and also to find a very human and remarkably moving story. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to remind you that you can always let us know about what you think of what you hear here on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to Howard Gelman, who's on controls here this morning, and to Dan Zoll, who is our senior editor, also to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.